November 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss warns Russia against attacking Ukraine as Moscow holds military drill.
And we are working with our partners in NATO, but also directly with Ukraine to make sure that they are fully supported.
The US accuses China of, quote, hacking and quietly stealing email and data from organizations, unquote.
We're looking at what was large byte transfer, basically large amounts of data leaving one of our customers' networks.
And President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris joined their spouses to give Thanksgiving meal to the needy in Washington. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. U.S. President Joe Biden was joined by his wife, First Lady Dr. Jill Biden, and Vice President Kamala Harris and her husband, Doug Emhoff, at D.C.'s Central Kitchen, as they helped to put together Thanksgiving Day meals for the needy. Later, the Bidens traveled to Nantucket, an island off the coast of Massachusetts, to spend the holiday with their family, resuming a decades-old tradition that was interrupted last year due to the pandemic. Biden has celebrated Thanksgiving on Nantucket nearly every year since 1975. The island, about 30 miles south by ferry from Cape Cod, has long been a favored vacation spot for the wealthy, though more during the summer months than the Thanksgiving. Biden broke with family tradition in 2015 after the death of his son, Beau, from brain cancer, and in 2020 after his election as president because of the pandemic, when he followed public health guidance to avoid travel and large gatherings. The president spoke about reuniting with family this Thanksgiving in remarks earlier this month while encouraging people to take their COVID-19 vaccines. The White House says most federal workers are vaccinated, Associate Press correspondent Sally Adler reports.
One day after the deadline to get vaccinated, the Biden administration's vaccine mandate for millions of federal workers seems to be working. The White House says 92% of the 3.5 million federal workers covered by the mandate reported to the government that they are at least partially vaccinated. According to data provided by the White House, the highest number of partial vaccinations by the deadline was the Agency for International Development, followed closely by the Department of Health and Human Services. The government organization with the least number of partially vaccinated employees, the Agriculture Department. I'm Shelley Adler.
British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss warned Russia on Wednesday that it would be making, quote, a grave mistake, unquote, if it attacked Ukraine, and said London was working closely with its NATO allies to support Russia's neighbor. Ukrainian U.S. officials have voiced concerns about a possible attack, a suggestion that Kremlin has dismissed as false. The independent Russian news agency Interfax reports that earlier on Wednesday, Russian fighter planes and ships practiced repelling air attacks on naval bases and responding with airstrikes during military drills in the Black Sea, as Ukraine also held combat exercises.
We are very close allies of Ukraine, and we are working with our partners in NATO, but also directly with Ukraine to make sure that they are fully supported.
That's British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss. The US and other governments say China was behind one of the biggest hacks of all time, quietly stealing email and data from organizations. Experts say China-orchestrated attacks on strategic targets have increased in recent years. Michelle Quinn reports.
On a January evening, the cybersecurity firm Velocity, which is always looking for anything unusual on the networks of its clients, including governments, the defense industry, and financial firms, detected an anomaly. Stephen Adair is the president of Velocity.
We're looking at what was large amounts of data leaving one of our customers' networks. Hair in our arms raising a little bit. We're kind of alarms going off at this point.
That discovery turned out to be a stealth operation to exploit an unknown vulnerability in Microsoft Exchange, an email server used by businesses, governments, and other organizations that have large numbers of users. The hackers were stealing emails. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden and its allies said the initial breach was the result of a Chinese state-sponsored hack. China has denied any connection to the Microsoft hack. An article in its state-run newspaper, Global Times, blamed the U.S. for cyber attacks against China. For Stephen Adair of Velocity, some early clues in the Microsoft Exchange hack pointed to China, such as the language in some of the code, where the data was going, and the kinds of targets.
So, you know, kind of like a pure cyber espionage play, to where the goal is to get information, to get data, to get email. What they want exactly and what they do with it, you know, we don't know. We can only speculate. But highly targeted operation, really under the radar.
While Russia-based hackers have been responsible for some of the biggest cyber attacks in the U.S., cybersecurity firms say that over the past 2 years, Beijing has directed more cyber operations targeting countries in Asia as well as nations worldwide to gather social, economic, and political intelligence. In their recent virtual meeting, Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping discuss how to reduce cyber conflicts between the two countries. Josephine Wolf is a cybersecurity policy expert at Tufts University. She spoke to VOA over Zoom.
I think what you're seeing now is this realization that actually the Chinese espionage efforts never disappeared and in fact became significantly more technologically sophisticated.
In the Microsoft Exchange hack, word of the weakness got out before the company created a patch. Hacking groups from around the world were able to exploit this virtual backdoor and indiscriminately attack targets. Stephen Adair.
We got organizations from all around the world, ranging from big defense contractors and government agencies down to like small mom and pop like shops, like funeral homes, like school districts. I put that up there as one of the worst or best, how everyone would describe it, of hacks probably of all time.
President Biden recently signed a bipartisan infrastructure bill into law that includes nearly $2 billion for cybersecurity. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
The State Department says Special Representative for Afghanistan, Thomas West, will head to Doha, Qatar next week for meetings with Taliban leaders. West told VOA the U.S. is deeply concerned about the humanitarian crisis in the country, as VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Conditions are dire in many parts of Afghanistan, with the United Nations World Food Program saying almost 24 million people, or 60% of the population, are suffering from acute hunger. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said U.S. Special Representative Tom West will discuss issues of vital U.S. national interest, including counterterrorism and humanitarian assistance, with Taliban leaders in 2 days of meetings in Doha, Qatar. In an exclusive interview with VOA Tuesday, West said Afghanistan's worsening humanitarian crisis has a lot to do with the loss of international aid. The Afghan economy depended on that aid to a large degree over 20 years. Thomas West, the U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan, spoke with VOA on Tuesday.
Some 75% of the former government's public expenditures were foreign donor funded. Some 40% of the country's GDP was foreign donor funded. And so really in our engagement and frankly in our allies and partners' engagement with the Taliban over a period of years, we made clear that if they chose a military path to power, that that aid would disappear. And that is what occurred.
Last week, the Taliban's foreign ministry spokesperson called on the U.S. Congress to release Afghan assets frozen after the Taliban takeover of the country. He said the economic misery at home could prompt a mass exodus and refugee problems for other countries. West said it is not as simple as the Taliban might think to get aid that is frozen in the U.S. and other countries moving again.
There are very complicated legal reasons as well as judicial reasons for why that money is not moving from particular banks into other places.
There has been some localized progress towards U.S. and international demands for the Taliban to respect human and women's rights. Schools for girls from grades 7 to 12 have reopened in Afghanistan's third largest city, Herat. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Poland has threatened Belarus with further economic sanctions and the closure of its borders to all freight and rail traffic as thousands of migrants continue to try to cross the frontier. The European Union accuses Belarus of creating a humanitarian crisis by ferrying migrants to the border in retaliation for EU sanctions imposed over last year's rigged election. Harry Ridwell reports.
Facing off across the frontier, Polish border guards filmed this footage Tuesday night, purportedly showing Belarusian security forces next to a section of broken border fence. Poland's Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki said Wednesday he was ready to escalate the response to what he called a political crisis triggered by Belarus, using innocent people as human shields. He said, we want to relieve this tension, but if there is an escalation by the other side, the Belarusian side, we are ready to go, unfortunately, up on this escalation ladder. For example, imposing economic sanctions, border closure, closing border crossings for freight and rail traffic. The EU said Tuesday it is preparing emergency legal measures on migrant asylum and return procedures. President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen.
The aim is to support member states to set up the right processes, to manage irregular arrivals in a swift and orderly way, in line with fundamental rights.
Tensions have eased in recent days after Belarus moved some migrants away from the border. Still, hundreds remain stuck in camps in freezing conditions. Several migrants have already died attempting the crossing. 28-year-old Diyar is a migrant from Iraq.
The Poland no have way, the Belarusian no have a way. We can't go anywhere. We are stay here to the Europe accept us.
A report from Human Rights Watch, based on interviews with dozens of migrants, details how Belarusian forces cut the razor wire fence to help the migrants cross into Poland, where they are usually picked up by Polish border guards. Human Rights Watch report author Lydia Gull.
They pleaded with the Polish border guards for asylum, for international protection, and if a person does, then it's the responsibility of state authorities to process these claims. Now, in the what the people told me is that none of this happens. Rather, they're being put in vans or cars and being, and then, you know, Polish border guards drive them down to specific locations at the border with Belarus, where they force them to cross through the fence and go back to the Belarusian side.
The migrants say they are then held in open-air camps on the Belarusian side of the border. Again, Lydia Gal.
They are not provided food or water. They're quite often violently abused by the border guards. They're extorted for money. They will then march larger groups of people back towards the Polish fence, where they will coerce them to go back into Poland. And so that's when you have this so-called ping-pong pushbacks.
Poland denies breaking any asylum laws. Belarus also denies its border guards have committed abuses. Among the latest casualties of the crisis, an unborn child, miscarried by his mother as the family crossed the border. His tiny coffin was buried Tuesday in a Muslim Tatar cemetery close to the border in Poland. NVOA News, London.
The US, France and Germany have joined other countries in urging their citizens to leave Ethiopia as fighting between federal forces and rebel groups move closer to the capital, Addis Ababa. The UN has also announced evacuation flights for family members of its staff in the country. The president of neighboring Kenya and South Africa have joined calls for an urgent ceasefire. Mohamed Yusuf speaks to analysts on the prospects for peace in this report from VOA's Africa News Center in Nairobi, Kenya.
As the security situation worsens in Ethiopia, there are increasing concerns about what happens next. William Davison is the International Crisis Group's senior analyst for Ethiopia.
There is a real prospect of the war coming to Addis Ababa, and that could have even more terrible consequences than we've seen so far. We could see very serious urban warfare. We could see Amhara-Oromo clashes if the OLA is involved. Lots of popular resistance, obviously, to the Tigray forces. The potential for a breakdown in government authority. If there's an effort at regime change, we could see the violence against Tigrayan civilians increase and the repression rapidly. So definitely need for a ceasefire.
CNN reports the U.S. military has prepared special forces to assist its embassy workers and citizens if the security situation deteriorates in the Horn of African nation. Briefing reporters in Washington Tuesday, U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, said there was progress in getting all parties to agree to a ceasefire. Feldman expressed fears the military confrontation threatens Ethiopia's stability and unity. The Kenyan and South African presidents Tuesday also called for a ceasefire. In November of last year, armed conflict broke out in the Tigray region between Ethiopian government forces and the Tigray People's Liberation Front. Since then, the conflict has spread to other parts of the country. Tigray forces and the Oromo Liberation Army threatens to drive Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed out of power by storming Addis Ababa. On Tuesday, Abiy said he will be at the front line to guide troops against the advancing rebel groups. Tobias Wellner is a sub-Saharan Africa senior intelligence analyst with the Dragonfly Intelligence, a group that works on global security and political risks. He says Abiy's plan to lead the military on the battlefront is to keep the troops' morale high.
Is really to rally support as the government is clearly struggling to defend sort of against the advancing rebel forces. I personally think it's very unlikely that Abiy is actually going to fight himself, and it's more like a, you know, propaganda act. And it also literally means that, you know, it's a sign that Abiy will not sort of, he will fight rather than step down from his position.
On Wednesday, Ethiopia government spokesman Legis Tulu said the prime minister had arrived at the battlefront without giving details. Tulu also said Abiy's deputy, Demeke Mekonnen Hassan, is handling government activities while he's away. Wellner says a victory for either the rebel groups or the government will create more rebellion in the country. He says there will be no winner in this war.
The connections between the TDF and the OLA and other rebel groups that have joined the fray is a very cautious and sort of not very strong alliance. Right now, they're all under the umbrella of opposing Abiy Ahmed. But, you know, if they need to rule Ethiopia, that's a whole other question. And then the ethnopolitics will come out and make that alliance very shaky, I think. Last scenario, stalemate. There's going to be some sort of ceasefire, but that'll be often broken.
The Tigray leadership is calling on lifting the humanitarian blockade so that more than 400,000 people can receive much-needed humanitarian assistance. The government wants Tigray forces and other rebel groups to leave areas of the country they have captured. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Indian farmers have welcomed Prime Minister Narendra Modi's decision to repeal three controversial farm laws that had led to the longest and largest protests about his government. However, as Anjana Patricia reports, the farmers plan to continue pressure on the government to meet other key demands.
These celebrations at protest sites near Delhi mark the victory farmers from North India have won with Prime Minister Narendra Modi's recent decision to repeal three contentious farm laws.
The truth always prevails. Our struggle was for a true cause. We were fighting for our rights. It was a peaceful but strong protest. This is a victory of the nation, the farmers.
It was a hard-won battle for farmers who camped and cooked on highways for a year, fearing that the pro-market reforms passed last year posed a threat to their land and livelihood.
This is the first time that the government has conceded to protesters' demands. Otherwise, dissenters are always chased away by police. But we, the Sikh community, were prepared to die for our cause.
But despite the rollback of the laws, it is uncertain when the protracted standoff will be over. Having savored victory, farmers are pressing for other concessions, such as a legal commitment for guaranteed prices for all farm produce, a system prevalent only for some crops like rice and wheat.
Farmers from all over the country have supported our cause. Now we have to make sure everyone gets a guaranteed price for their crops.
The capitulation on the farm laws by Modi, a leader who seldom backs down, is widely attributed to the need to regain their support ahead of elections in key states. Farmers are a huge voting bloc.
The Prime Minister has stooped to conquer I think he's calculated the balance of advantage lay in taking a back step than to continue with the, you know, the standoff that had taken place.
But the year-long protest that weathered a harsh winter, summer, and even a pandemic has frayed trust between the farmers and the government. Days after the Prime Minister urged them to go home, they are still huddled along the highways.
जब तक हमें रिटर्न पूरा नहीं मिलेगा कंप्लीट हमें नहीं मिलेगा कुछ भी तो हम तब तक यहां पर यहीं पर हैं यहीं पर प्रोटेस्ट करेंगे जब हमें एमएसपी पर गारंटी मिलेगी बिल्कुल सांसद में पास हो जाएगा प्रेसिडेंट जी की साइन हो जाएंगे उस पर स्टैंप लगेगी तब हम यहां से जाएंगे घर को तब तक नहीं तो यहीं पर हैं
The key question is, can Prime Minister Modi rebuild their trust and restore his image as a pro-farmer leader in the coming months? Anjana Pasricha for VOA News.
In other news, NASA has launched a spacecraft on a mission to smash into an asteroid and test whether it will be possible to knock a spinning space rock off course if one were to threaten Earth. The DART spacecraft, short for Double Asteroid Redirection Test, lifted up from Vandenberg Space Force Base atop a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket in a $330 million project with echoes of Bruce Willis' movie, quote, Armageddon, unquote. If all goes well, the boxy 1,200-pound craft will slam head-on into Dimorphos, an asteroid 525 feet across at 15,000 miles per hour next September. Dimorphos orbits a much larger asteroid called Didymos. The pair are no danger to Earth, but offer scientists a better way to measure the effectiveness of a collision than a single asteroid flying through space. Dimorphos completes an orbit of Didymos every 11 hours 55 minutes. DART's goal is a crash that will slow Dimorphos down and cause it to fall closer towards the bigger asteroids, shaving 10 minutes off its orbit. DART will take 10 months to reach the asteroid pair. The collision will occur about 6.8 million miles from Earth. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Junaid Wafa in Washington. Thousands of Iraqi Kurdish university students came to the streets on Tuesday to demand the government reinstate monthly stipends that were halted since 2014. VOA's Dilshad Anwar has more from Suleymaniyah in this report narrated by Bazan Hamdad.
Thousands of Kurdish students took to the streets of numerous cities in northern Iraq, including Suleymaniyah and Erbil, on Tuesday, demanding their monthly stipends be restored by the autonomous government of Iraqi Kurdistan. Due to falling oil prices and a costly campaign against the Islamic State terror group, the government stopped paying the stipends, worth about $50, in 2014.
Look, all the young people are leaving this country. They are all gone. They have left the region because of these thieves.
Protests have been going on in Suleymaniyah for 3 days. They reportedly grew bigger and more violent on Tuesday. Local media report that several protesters were injured and security personnel deployed tear gas to disperse the crowds. Protesters also set fire to the city's ruling party's offices. Some shouted more radical slogans such as Down with Family Rule, a reference to the Barzani and Talibani family's three-decade duopoly over the oil-rich region.
We have students who have deferred their studies because they have no money. I know a few girls in the dorm who wash their friends' clothes to earn some money for that day.
Even though the regional parliament had a special session on Tuesday to debate the problem, the protests showed no sign of subsiding. In an attempt to calm the crowds, authorities at Suleymaniyah University scheduled a 2-day recess. But on Tuesday, at least one university dean joined the protesters to show support for their demands.
We support the students' demands. We consider them legitimate and within their rights.
Students in Suleymaniyah barricaded major roadways, promising to keep protesting until their demands are met. For Dilshad Anwar in Suleymaniyah, Iraq, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
The chief rabbi of Iran's tiny Jewish minority presented a mixed picture of Jewish life in Islamic Republic as he spoke to American Jews this month at the end of a rare five-week visit to the U.S. Yehuda Garami highlighted positive trends and challenges, but some observers say life for Jews in Iran may be more difficult than he described. VOA's Michael Lippin reports.
Fairfax, Virginia Synagogue was the final stop for Iran's chief rabbi, Yehuda Garami, on a tour of U.S. Jewish communities to raise awareness about the situation of Jews in the Islamic Republic. There are about 9,000 Jews in Iran, according to the U.S. State Department. They live among 85 million people, 99% of whom are Muslims. Garami said that in recent years, his community has had some successes, like persuading Iranian authorities to let Jewish schools close on Saturdays for the Sabbath, the Jewish day of rest.
Also, we now have about six kosher restaurants in Tehran with a higher observance of Jewish dietary laws than before. And we opened a Jewish seminary in Tehran for young men to learn to become rabbis.
But Garami said his community also has been under financial pressures from Iran's high inflation and weak economy that affect Iranians as a whole. Asked how he feels about Iran's Islamist rulers engaging in low-level conflict with the Jewish State of Israel, where he studied in his youth, Garami responded cautiously.
We always keep in mind that we have no interest in politics. We are Jews who only want to learn the Torah or Bible and perform good deeds as a religious duty. But there are times in which it is not easy to be a Jewish leader in Iran.
Some Iranian-American Jewish commentators believe Garami is reluctant to criticize Iran's rulers for fear of provoking them to retaliate against himself or his congregants. Judaism is one of three minority religions that Iran's Islamist constitution allows to be practiced. The other two are Christianity and Zoroastrianism. But Iranian law bars Jews and other recognized minorities from serving in the judiciary and security services. It also threatens Jews with prison for visiting Israel, a country Iran repeatedly has said should be destroyed. Such calls contributed to the U.S. labeling Iran as the world's top state sponsor of anti-Semitism last year, according to then U.S. Deputy Special Envoy to Combat Anti-Semitism, Eli Kohanim.
It's not only about their genocidal desire to, quote unquote, eliminate Israel, to quote the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei himself, but also because they deny that the Holocaust ever took place. And thirdly, because of their terrorist proxy activity, whether it's funding and training Hamas in Gaza, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and even the Houthis in Yemen.
Iran had about 85,000 Jews at the time of its 1979 Islamic Revolution, according to Encyclopedia Iranica. Most fled Islamist rule by emigrating in the decades that followed. But thousands remain. Most Iranian Muslims treat them well, says Iranian-American journalist Carmel Melamed.
They really don't look at their countrymen as far as their religion. They respect them. There's a sense of tolerance. There's a sense of respect with their neighbors, co-workers, friends.
But Melamed says Iran's Jews still live under an Islamist government that treats them like second or third class citizens. Michael Lippin, VOA News, Fairfax, Virginia.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington, wishing you a wonderful day.
This is the voice of America. Washington, ba ba boos.